each meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
Hey, welcome everyone. God bless you for tuning into The Winds Have Changed. It's a Wednesday for listening live. That means with Father Tom Coy's Brain Wrinkling Wednesday. I hope this will wrinkle your brain. It's a challenge. I started.
You're going to need a bigger boat.
Yeah, we always need a bigger boat. We always need a bigger mind. We always need a bigger soul. We always need a bigger heart. And you know something about Catholicism? It stretches us. Catholicism is always opening new horizons. And that's a good thing, as long as they don't contradict or cause confusion or make us fall into the trap of moral relativism or doctrinal relativism. That's not leading us to the true God, who, as the Bible tells us, yesterday is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. Truth, when it's discovered, is something eternal. Comes from God, and therefore it doesn't change, as it were. And we're living in a time when relativism is so popular, and it's all around us. It's all around us. I mentioned the other day that my dear, precious 96-year-old mother is very close to the end. And when you walk through hospital these days, and when you deal with what we call, you know, the end of life issues, there's so many stones in the prayer gardens. There's plaques. There's posters, and they all kind of depress me in some way. They're not meant to depress me. They're meant to elevate me. They're meant to comfort me, but because they don't incorporate the truths that are eternal, that I accept as eternal truths that come from my faith in God and what happens when we die and where we go, and that God is our judge, and that God can give us a happiness and a beauty and a grace far beyond our wildest imagination, then for instance, there's one poster in the hospital near the CC's critical care unit that said, "For us who are left, you will always be with us in the trees and the flowers and the breeze and the sunshine." You know the kind of sentiments or thoughts that would come around. We've probably all said them in one way or another. We've probably all sent sympathy cards that contain those kinds of sentiments one way or another. But I couldn't help but think to myself, I don't want to live in the trees after I'm gone. I don't want to live in flowers. I want to live with the saints. I want a higher existence. I want the resurrection of the body and life everlasting. That's what I yearn for. That's what you don't get when our society is fearful of the truths, shall we say, of
precious faith.
Yeah, that's the way it goes. Anyways, I brought up the topic of Henry David Thoreau's classic book called Walden Pond and his search for the best life, his escape from the rat race of the big city that was Boston in his time in the 1870s, 80s, even as early before the Civil War time and all the rest. He doesn't really write too much about the Civil War. That such a huge event was going on in the United States, and he doesn't have a comment on it, I find a little disappointing. I couldn't imagine living through World War II without thinking a bit about why we were fighting, why people were dying. Same thing for the Civil War, of course, too. But anyways, he does touch on a lot of beautiful thoughts that are similar to many saintly thoughts, especially St. Francis of Assisi, but also a lot of other mystics. And I made a comparison with one of my poetic heroes by the name of John Denver, because I find the attraction that I have toward John Denver because of his love for nature, his innocence, in a sense, through his songs. Of course, people will quickly criticize him for not having innocence in his life, but he did capture in his songs a lot of that. And for that, he touched a lot of hearts and even, I'll say, changed a lot of hearts and comforted a lot of people in many of their difficulties. Anyways, I see a very strong parallel between Henry David Thoreau's attraction to people and the attraction that I have toward John Denver. But I think I didn't explain well enough the connection then that many Catholics today, and I used the example of Pope Francis's letter called Laudate Si. It's kind of his ode to the praise of the earth, and there's a lot of beautiful things he says, and he's trying to get people to appreciate nature, and I applaud him for that, as I applaud John Denver and David Thoreau. However, if you don't see what's missing in I'll just use these three persons, these three characters, Thoreau, Denver, and Pope Francis, or others that would be representative of these kinds of thoughts. If you don't see what's missing, teaching a half-truth sometimes is dangerous, and that's what we're experiencing in many ways today. We're teaching half-truths, and we're almost attacking those who will fill up what's missing.
Wow.
Fill up what's missing.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, that is. So I ended a show, I don't know if it was the last one or the one before that, anyways. Thoreau has an interesting poem to his fireplace. He doesn't name it in the book, but I'm going to call it an ode to his fireplace, or to my fireplace. I'm going to start with this because it's a good place to start, because it'll bring together, I think, the tension, the paradoxes that we need to see, and hopefully have the right appreciation for half-truths, but a yearning for the fullness of the truth, and where building a whole life on half-truths can really be dangerous for our own self and for the world at large. Okay, how's that? So he's if you know the book Walden Pond, you know he's,
wow,
he's a journalist.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, that is brain wriggling. He like, you almost get the feeling that he went out into the forest, not in the ultimate sense of I want to live this way for the rest of my life, but I, in order to get a good story, in order to write a good book. And he did. But he doesn't live there forever. He doesn't die there. I don't know how many exact years, but let's say 10 years, 12 years, something like that. He comes back and his writings are beautiful. He has great meditations on the simplicity of life, the place of man in nature, the ability to see God in nature. Though unfortunately he encloses his love for God in nature in a skepticism for God in church. This is something very popular today, of course, too, and we have to see why nature, though it can lead to God, doesn't lead us to God in the best of way, is not as good of a teacher, not as good of a leader as church is. True faith, the true church, as it were. Anyways, here, let me go through this. Let's start with this Ode to My Fireplace. He's here writing about his time in the winter. Of course, it would be pretty cold and snowy in a Massachusetts winter. So he says, the next winter, I used a small cooking stove for economy, since I did not own the forest. So in other words, he's saying to save money or to save trees. He felt a little guilty about cutting down all the trees just to warm himself, which probably he should have felt a little guilty about that, especially because you don't own the forest, as it were. But my cooking stove did not keep fire so well as the open fireplace. That's an interesting thing. Have you ever sat around a fireplace? I'm not sure what he's thinking about that. He must have, I don't know what kind of cooking stove he had, but unfortunately, many times when we sit around the fireplace, if you light a fire in the winter, 80% or maybe even 90% of the heat goes right up the chimney. So the typical fireplace isn't such a great practical tool for warming your house. You have to capture the heat and let it not go up the chimney, right? So depending on what kind of cooking stove he had, maybe that had a chimney that went straight up and most of the heat went up that way. So the only heat he was getting was from the little sides of the cooking stove, and more heat was coming from the open fireplace than the cooking stove. Anyways, the science behind the cooking stove versus the fireplace put aside for a moment, but he's going to share some beautiful thoughts which we can analyze in terms of modern science, what is done for practicality, what machines have done for us versus what nature itself does for us, those kinds of thoughts. That's what he's going to lead to. That's what the meaning of his Ode to My Fireplace poem is. So he says, cooking was then, for the most part, no longer poetic, but merely a chemical process. So he used to cook his food on the open fireplace, and you could see sort of the romantic, poetic side of cooking your food on an open fire like that. You hang a pot over it. It's kind of like the joy that's associated with camping, right? You go out and you make your coffee in the morning on a fire, or you cook your food on a fire pit. There's something poetic about that. Of course, people who don't like camping see right through it, and they say, poetic be damned, I'd like a good restaurant. unfortunately. Sometimes I feel that way myself, but I do like camping, and there is something poetic or romantic, shall we say. But anyways, he's lamenting this a little bit. So he says, it will soon be forgotten in these days of stoves. The it he's talking about is the poetic part of cooking your food, the part that gives you joy. And of course, a lot of people have joy in the kitchen. A lot of people enjoy cooking. A lot of people don't. And in order to enjoy it, you do have to have a sense of something poetic, whether it be the form of fire or the menu you're working on or the people you're going to serve. I don't know what this says about there's a new push today for environmentalism to get rid of gas stoves, have only electric stoves. That seems like a strange, you'd really have to prove to me that it's good. Yep, there's the reward room. It's nice and open here today. I hope I didn't wrinkle in too many brains just yet. Okay, my first segment is going by, and I wanted to get through this poem. He's setting his little poem up. He says, it, the romantic side of cooking and fireplaces, will soon be forgotten in these days of stoves that we used to roast potatoes in the ashes after the Indian tradition. The stove not only took up room and scented the house, but it concealed the fire, and I felt as if I had lost a companion, right? A stove, you close the door and you don't even see the fire so much. You can always see a face in the fire. That's interesting, right? You can always see a face in the fire. Now that fall is coming up, it reminds me of that Highlights magazine. Maybe you remember years ago when Injun summer came along and there were the little cartoon drawing of people, the Indians sitting around a fire and the flames of the fire turned into dancing Indians. That's what Thoreau is talking about here. I felt I had lost a companion. You can always see a face in the fire. The laborer, looking into it at evening, purifies his thoughts of the dross and earthiness which they have accumulated during the day. So if you're just a worker, you're a worker in a kitchen, you're even maybe even a slave or a paid cook, you're not going to have these romantic thoughts. It's you look at it in the dreariness of things. But I could no longer sit and look into the fire. So with his stove, he had a lot of comfort, as we, most of us do when we think about a fireplace, right? A fire cooking out there. But I could no longer sit and look into the fire. And the pertinent words of a poet recurred to me with new force. Okay, maybe this is not his poem. It doesn't say who wrote it, but I think we got to take our first break. My goodness, my introduction is going a little longer than I thought, but anyways, let's take our first break, okay, Nick? We're going to analyze Walden's Ode to a Fireplace, but let's take our first break. I'm Father Tom Coyes, guest host on The Winds of Change. You're listening to the new EWTN Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland. We are WSFI 88.5 FM and WNDZ AM 750.
It is amazing to be living in a post-Roe v. Wade America, but our country racked up a body count of tens of millions under Roe. And still today, the body count continues to rise, and the vast majority of these babies never received a proper burial. That's what the 11th Annual National Day of Remembrance for Aborted Children is all about. On Saturday, September 9th, on this special day, the Pro-Life Action League visits the burial places of aborted children and other memorials put up in their honor. And we solemnly pray for God to heal the deep wounds of abortion in our society. To find your nearest day of remembrance service, visit ProLifeActionLeague.org and click on the tile that says National Day of Remembrance for Aborted Children 2023. The National Day of Remembrance for Aborted Children, Saturday, September 9th.
I'm Father Tom Coyes, and you are listening to The Winds of Change.
Sometimes it's tough to hear winds of change over the air. What with tall buildings, power lines, and other static. Now you can hear Winds of Change anywhere, anytime, or on any device. When Winds of Change is on the air Monday through Friday, noon to 1, go to ststandschurch.org. Scroll down to the Winds of Change tile and click on the Listen Live button, or visit Winds of Change Facebook page to see the Listen Live link.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. I think that's my cue to start talking again. Okay, here's the poem that Henry David Thoreau uses in his book, Walden Pond. It's the Ode to a Fireplace. He goes like, and it sort of captures a lot of the whole meaning of his time at Walden Pond, captures a lot of what he's just trying to say throughout the book. He goes like this. Never bright flame may be denied to me, thy dear life imaging, close sympathy. What but my hopes shot upward ere so bright? What but my fortunes sunk so low in night? Why art thou banished from our hearth and hall? Thou who art welcomed and beloved by all, was thy existence then too fanciful for our life's common light, who are so dull? Did thy bright gleam mysterious converse hold with our congenial souls, secrets too bold? Well, we are safe and strong, for now we sit beside a hearth where no dim shadows flint, where nothing cheers nor saddens, but a fire warms feet and hands, nor does to more aspire, by whose compact utilitarian heap the present may sit down and go to sleep, nor fear the ghosts who from the dim past walked, and with us by the unequal light of the old wood fire talked. I think that's precious. He's lamenting the fact that stoves have taken over fireplaces. And you got to admit that most of our houses today are heated by furnaces. You don't see the fire. We don't really worry about that. And just that sitting around a fireplace or open fire pit on a camping trip, does have a different feel, of course, to it.
Wow.
This is capturing.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
That is brain wrinkling, I'd say. So he's lamenting modern culture. Remember, this is in the 1800s. He's lamenting modern culture because of all the technology and the fast-paced living that the Industrial Revolution is ushering into society. And he's missing it in a certain sense. And that's a good thing. I think we catch some of that today when people say, don't use your computer so much, too much time on the screen, your cell phone, too much time on social media is detrimental to your spiritual life, as it were. And so he would be happy with those parents who say to their children, only 2 hours, 3 hours, or what have you, of computer time, etc. And so he's knocking the progress of mankind, though I think most of us today don't want to fall into the Amish camp of knocking so much of modern technology that we avoid electricity, or we avoid modern machinery. And I can't help but, and I'm sure you've sensed the, in some ways, hypocrisy of Amish folks who live without computers or live without electricity until they need something really bad, and then they'll go to the store that uses both electricity and computers and all the rest. It's a feeling you get about modern technology, and you can build your life around that feeling, but it can be dangerous, as it were, and it may not be the fulfillment of God's plan. That's what G.K. Chesterton, I think I talked about this at another episode, where Chesterton, in his book about his own conversion, compares his discovery of Catholicism, he compares it to his vision of walking through a giant auditorium or warehouse where all these exhibits exist about religions. And before his conversion, he imagined all the different religions were like walking and examining, looking at, investigating, probing the different denominational religions, mostly Protestant denominations, but you could even throw in Muslim, Judaism, Hinduism, any other religions. The point is that he looked upon or imagined Catholicism to be one of those exhibits in the big hall, but it was old and dilapidated and not as exciting, not as interesting. So Catholicism, he used to think, was just this old form of religiosity that had to pass away with the progress of time. And so that exhibit called Catholicism was old and dilapidated, and no one really cared for it. But then as he studied Catholicism, as he studied the faith of the saints, as he read catechism more and theologians like Thomas Aquinas, and he loved St. Francis of Assisi, two very different kinds of saints, but both strong Catholic saints, the more he discovered about Catholicism, his vision of Catholicism changed. It was no longer the old dilapidated exhibit in the big hall. Catholicism was the big hall. Catholicism was everything, in the sense that all the different branches of spirituality latch on to one aspect, one sentiment, one concept of religiosity, and you build a whole religion around that one, where he discovered that that's not the right religion. To embrace one religion, to embrace Catholicism, is to see that Catholicism had in it both those who are seeking to be a hermit or live a very simple life, like the Amish or the Quakers, you might say. You can find that in Catholic saints, but they won't start their own church. They'll be a brand. We call them religious communities, Franciscans or Augustinians, or monasteries or Poor Clares. All the different kinds of religions might have that simplicity that the Amish or Quakers have in some way, but not divorced from the doctrine and the hierarchical structure where you fit in. Anyways, okay, so Walden is criticizing modern technology, which we sometimes want to join in on him, but we stop that after a while when we want to get from Chicago to Los Angeles, and we'd much rather jump on an airplane than start walking. We forget our disdain for modern technology when we go to the hospital and we need a doctor's help in one way or another, right? Can't help but think of that with my mother so sick and so close to the end. Say a prayer for The Ode to the Fireplace captures that little sentiment, and he's praising the beauty of sitting around the fire when he says, "What but my hopes shot upward or so bright?" So he's saying, when you sat around the fireplace, you would imagine your hopes and your dreams. You'd let yourself daydream in front of a fireplace, and you'd see the sparks going up, and that was sort of symbolic of your hopes and your higher thoughts. "What but my fortunes sunk so low in night?" Of course, at nighttime, the fire would die down, and you'd say, "Oh, got to get up and stoke the fire." And in that was a kind of parable, a kind of an analogy of your hopes in life. If you don't stoke your hopes in life, you get married in youth, you grow older, and your marriage seems mediocre or bad at times, and you realize if you don't stoke the fire of your marriage, it's going to die out. "What art thou banished from our hearth and hall?" No, why art thou banished? Why have we gotten rid of fireplaces and replaced them with stoves? Or we can modernize his words by saying furnaces today, right? Well, we all know why we've done it. It's so much more convenient. We use less resources. We can spread the heat out more evenly. All those people who work with air conditioning and heating know exactly what we're talking about. And we prefer it today. But still, we've lost something Henry David Thoreau is talking about. Let's see, we go on a little bit more. "Thou who art welcomed and beloved by all." Doesn't everybody love a fireplace? When you go search for a house, don't you say, "Oh, doesn't this have a beautiful fireplace?" If you look at a house and doesn't have a fireplace, you'll say, "Well, that one has a fireplace and this one doesn't. I prefer the one with a fireplace." And what do we adorn the fireplace with on the mantle? We always put one of our favorite pictures or the people of our family, right? The pictures of our family. So he's got a point there that the fireplace is beloved by all. "Why? Was thy existence then too fanciful for our life's common light, who are so dull?" did we have our lives are so dull that we didn't appreciate the beauty of a fireplace over? "Did thy bright gleam mysterious converse hold with our congenial souls secrets too bold?" So he's saying, did we get rid of the fireplace because it's in those meditations that we have around the fireplace that touched on the conversations so bold, touching our congenial souls? Were those secrets too bold and we didn't like meditating on those things, so we got rid of the fireplace? All these things are precious, but they're not absolute. They're not. You can certainly meditate on life's deep secrets in an adoration chapel, shall we say. We don't need a fireplace. You can do so in a beautiful house that has a furnace, right? But again, he's poetic, and he's pushing us to think in this beautiful way. He ends with, "Well, we are safe and strong, for now we sit beside a hearth where no dim shadows flint." Of course, if you have a stove in your house and it's warming your... And his little house on Walden Pond was a one-room, small house. And so if there's a fire in the fireplace, obviously there's going to be lots of shadows cast onto the wall. But with a stove, you don't get that. So he says, "Where nothing cheers nor saddens, but a fire warms feet and hands, nor does it more aspire." So the stove, all it does is heat us. heat keeps us warm, but it doesn't inspire us anymore. By whose compact utilitarian heap the present may sit down and go to sleep. Now there's the philosophical line that is worth utilitarian heap. He's cautioning us against just the utilitarian view of life. And I guess you can push that to an extreme. Communism, socialism pushes us to view man as economic man, as it were. It's losing the romantic side of human life. It's losing the spiritual side, the soul, the quest for something higher than just surviving throughout life, the utilitarian heap. Nor fear the ghosts who from the dim past walked, and with us by the unequal light of the old wood fire talked. So obviously the shadows, you might you're sitting around, especially if you're by yourself. He was by himself so much right there. Isn't it the same that we might think, oh, these are ghosts from old? And so you could say, well, don't be superstitious. You shouldn't be thinking that there's ghosts in the shadows cast on the wall, created by the fireplace. But he's saying more than that, of course. If we lose a complete sense of the evil spirits, as it were, he doesn't say this, but I'm going to say it for him. We, as believers today, we need to appreciate demons as well as angels. And if we appreciate them by means of a fireplace, then I'll by all means sit by a fireplace. But you have to be catechized to get to that kind of awareness of reality around you. Okay, so all right, I want to dive a little bit more into the rest of his book, but we'll take a little break here, our second break, and I do want to try to make clear the connection I'm making with my love for John Denver and my disappointment with John Denver. My love for what many Catholics, like for instance Pope Francis, do when they promote a love for the earth, and my disappointment in what they don't share, as it were. Anyways, let's take our second break, and we'll be back here again in a little bit. I'm Father Tom Coyes, guest host on The Winds of Change. You are listening to the new EWTN Catholic Radio Voice for Chicagoland. We are WSFI 88.5 FM and WNDZ AM 750.
St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy, is open 24 hours a day, 7 days per week, for adoration of the Blessed Sacrament in the iconic monstrance. The Blessed Sacrament is reposed during the celebration of Mass and during special events. St. Stan's doors are always open for adoration. Come anytime, day or night. St. Stan's is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, right off the Kennedy. Visit ststanschurch.org.
We are the students of St. Stanislaus-Kostka Academy.
Your children can join them for face-to-face classroom instruction. Visit ststanschicago.org to find out how.
And you're listening to The Winds of Change.
St. Stanislaus-Kostka Academy. St. Stan's is an exceptional private elementary school in Chicago, serving preschool, age 3 and 4, pre-kindergarten, kindergarten, and first grades. We incorporate Catholic values and rigorous academic social-emotional learning, Chinese, Spanish, STEM, and more, providing our students with leadership and life skills to transform our world. St. Stanislaus-Kostka Academy is conveniently located 1 block north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. To schedule your tour, visit ststanschicago.org. ststanschicago.org.
Hey, I think that's me, my cue to come back here with you. God bless you for being with us when the winds of change. Remember, you can always listen to The Winds of Change and many wonderful audio shows on things called podcasts. I hope you know how to do a podcast. That's how I listen to most of my stuff. We are on an app called Podbean. Of course, a lot of your phones and computers have podcast apps themselves, and you be sure to search for Winds of Change Show. Winds of Change Show. You might even put in Father Anthony Bush, who we have to keep in our prayers, as always. What a guy, fighting not only the battle of biological life, but the spiritual battles that we find all around us. Anyways, okay, so I hope you appreciated that ode to a fireplace, because it does capture the beauty, and I think we all know and we all appreciate the beauty of nature, the beauty of simplicity, the reticence or the ugliness of just being economic man, all practical and no fun, all business and no love, shall we say. You know, that's what the whole Christmas story of Scrooge, right, was all about. He was just counting his shekels and didn't have time for Christmas. Bah, humbug, right? And so that's a little bit what Walden is saying. And that's a lot of why I like John Denver. And I love our national parks. I love our national parks. They bring that beauty, and you have to have a simplicity. You have to enjoy the rustic side of existence. The modern conveniences stripped away sometimes do make you appreciate, shall we say, the finer things of life, as it were. They can, but they don't necessarily do such a thing anyways, right? Here's another song of John Denver that I want to share with you, because it reminds me of what Walden is saying and doing. It's one of my favorite songs, I gotta say that. Maybe you know it. It's called Sweet Surrender. And it does have that spirit of St. Francis. Here's how it goes. Do you remember this one? I don't know if you can hear it. This is the best recording of it, but...
I'll stand alone on some forgotten highway, drive by to remember you, looking for something that I can't believe, looking for something I'd like to do with my life.
Gotta stop it there, isn't it? He's lost and alone on some forgotten highway, traveled by many but remembered by few. That's, in other words, he's going through life. Everybody goes through life. But the difficulty of settling down with a purpose in life, settling down with the right spouse in life, friends, family, etc., and he's looking for something to do with his life. There's a little prayer that we say with our altar boys before Mass, which points out, Lord, help me know my vocation in life. And the man who helps with our servers, wonderful, wonderful guy, he often stops when we're saying that prayer, and he says to the boys, now think of that line, to find your vocation in life. And he points to me, and he points to himself, and he says, Father and I already know our vocation. We're up there in years, and we've embraced our vocation. But you have to ask the good Lord what your vocation is going to be. And that's sort of what John Denver is singing about here, and that's probably why I liked it, as it were, because I was looking for something to do with my life. When he was popular, when I first heard these songs, and I played the record over and over again. We don't have records anymore, but they're coming back, though. The vinyls, right? The vinyls coming back. So And then he goes on. This is the beautiful part.
There's nothing behind me, nothing that ties me to something that might have been true yesterday.
I got to stop it there because I even remember thinking of that. Wait a minute, you're going to throw away something that might have been true yesterday? Now, if you're talking about, well, compared to his personal life, he grew up as an Air Force brat. His father was a colonel in the Air Force, and they were moving around. So if you're going to say, and this is, I think, probably what he was thinking when he wrote those lines, it was true that my home was in Texas. Now it's not true anymore. It was true that my home was in Minnesota. And it's not true anymore. It was true that my home was in Nebraska. He did bounce around a lot. It's not. So there are certain things that were true yesterday, but are not true today. But unless you critically understand, if you take that sentiment, that doctrine, and apply it in a wider sense about God, about human life, about nature, about what is real and what is not real, that there is a heaven. You learn that there is a heaven when you're little, but then you're going to grow up and you're going to read that that's not true today, etc. That's where poetry is different than philosophy, than different than theology. It touches our heart in a sense, but can miss the working of our intellect, as it were. So he's saying that, and that touched me. I remember thinking that, yeah, something. What am I going to do? I could cut the strings and go where I want. perhaps I remember that the album Rocky Mountain High had John Denver standing on a rock in the middle of a Rocky Mountain stream. And I thought, oh man, would I love to be there and stand there and live there and everything. Of course, it never happened when I was young, but it had that sentiment of running away from the big city and finding peace and happiness in the wilderness and the mountains. I have since discovered, because of a friend of mine who knew exactly where John Denver was standing when he took that picture. It's a place called Slaughterhouse Falls, just outside of Aspen, Colorado. And sure enough, that stream, Rocky Mountain Whitewater Stream, is still there today. No, he took that picture not that long ago. My friend who showed me where that was, I was out there with my sister Mary Lou, and Mary Lou and I crawled down the side of the embankment there, and we went and stood on those rocks, and I'm still wondering if he had the idea of doing what he did at the time he took the picture. He says, go down there, stand on the rocks, and I'll take a picture of you. So he took a picture of me. He took a number of pictures, me by myself, and then with Mary Lou, my sister, as we stood there in the midst of the swirling wave water. Later, he sends me a Photoshop picture. He took my picture standing on that rock, and he superimposed John Denver standing on the rock from that Rocky Mountain album. And I hope I still have that somewhere. One of the more precious pictures that I ever remember. And it does capture that sense of running away from the rat race we call life and sort of discovering a peacefulness in nature. We all like that. Okay, but still, here he goes on. Tomorrow is open.
Tomorrow is open. Right now seems to be more than fun. Just be here today. I don't know what the future is holding in store. Don't know where I'm going. I'm not sure where I am.
Isn't that the refrain of almost every young adult, teenager? Unless you really are focused, you don't know what you're going to do for the rest of your life. You're just confused, and that's anxiety producing, isn't it? What am I going to do with my life? And people always ask you, what's your major? As soon as you go to college, the first question people ask you after where you go to college is, what's your major? And if you don't have a strong sense of, well, some people say, well, I want to be a doctor. I want to be an electrician. Or, well, you don't need to go to college to be an electrician. But you know what I'm saying. It is that anxiety time, as it were, when you don't really feel the direction of your life, as it were. But this song sort of says, the heck with it. He goes on. He's
sings it. There's a spirit that guides me. The light shines for me. My life is worth living. I don't need to see it.
Now there is an interesting, that little line, I don't need to see the end. There's a spirit that guides me. And of course, you could say the Holy Spirit. Of course, you're not going to say that in a popular song, but you can certainly interpret that, and that's how I interpret it. Well, I loved him. There's a spirit that's guiding me, and it guided me to the priesthood, which I'm very, very grateful for. Required a lot of self-sacrifice, and there was a anxiety about it, but it was feeling like I was following a spirit that was guiding me. But when he says, I don't need to see the end, a real paradox comes, because we all know that John Denver died young with that plane crash. I don't need to see the end. Oh, if he knew that he was going to die at a certain age, after, as his career was fading, he certainly wasn't a pauper. He made enough money, but even somebody who has a lot of money and had fame before misses being on the top of his career, right? Like sports heroes often talk about, when are you going to retire? Got to retire at the pinnacle of your career. Wasn't it Michael Jordan that retired so many times? He wanted to retire at the pinnacle of his career. When is that? You push it. I can do one more year. But also, that line in the song, I don't need to see the end, you could replace the word end with the philosophical meaning of the word end, as in purpose. Now that's where I'm going to say, I'm going to take out my umpire, my referee's flag, and throw down a penalty flag. You do need to see the end, as it were, in the purpose. We need to discover the purpose of life. And that's the big difference between a St. Francis of Assisi and a Walden, who wasn't so, well, he was religious, but he obviously wasn't as religious. He doesn't become a saint like St. Francis.
Wow.
So many.
You just wrinkled my brain, man.
Yeah, you need to see the end as in the purpose. And he trusts it. The next part of the song is sort of like how we trust.
Sweet.
Okay, that line could have been taken exactly from St. Francis, right? If you've ever seen any good movies about or read stories about St. Francis, that's exactly what he was saying. The birds neither reap nor sow, and yet God takes care of them, just like Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, right? And so St. Francis says, well, why do I have to be my father's son and work in his textile business? I'm going to leave that behind and trust the good Lord. It's another reason why I liked John Denver so much, because I interpreted that sweet surrender was a surrender to the will of God, a surrender to following the vocation of being a priest and being a good Catholic, though it's so very easy to sing that refrain that could be the anthem of all those people that are homeless and sleeping in Seattle in their little tents or under the viaducts all around the big cities of the United States. They will say, I'm living without care. Sweet surrender, live without care, like a fish in the water. Fish doesn't worry about where he's going to sleep or what he's going to eat, what kind of job he's going to have. And so it's very easy to misinterpret that sentiment in a way that will lead you to being homeless on the street and not to a more beautiful life, a more established life. He, John Denver, certainly shared beautiful thoughts when he was sharing that, but he certainly loved his beautiful mansion in Aspen, Colorado. when I was in Aspen once, I was able to look upon some of those gorgeous million-dollar or multi-million-dollar homes spread around. And he had security guards just like anybody else, or any other rich person, obviously. So, again, there's this spirit that is true to a certain point. And going back to what Chesterton says, yes, there's something in there, but it's not the fullness of the truth. The fullness of the truth makes us realize that you have to care. You can't live without care for your neighbor. You can't live without care for your eternal salvation. You can't live without care for helping your society, helping your nation. And boy, I think that's so crucial today as we see our greater and greater aspects of our Christian culture being taken over by more paganistic, pantheistic. That's the great danger of John Denver, Wald, Thoreau, and even Catholic voices like Pope Francis. If you're going to point people to love nature, you have to warn of the problem of pantheism. And that's what is missing. If you don't appreciate the dangers of pantheism, you will turn into a pagan, worshiping the moon instead of God. That's another G.K. Chesterton beautiful thought and sentiment. He said, when people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything. And the anything that they sink their teeth into is a creature, not the creator. Or so. I've got to finish this fun song. It goes like this. Well, let me jump in and interrupt John Denver by saying, if you're looking for something to believe in Almighty God, believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, as the second person of the Trinity, believe in Catholicism and the lives of the saints. They teach us, they guide us better than an eagle soaring through the sky or a fire in the fireplace. Those are ambiguous, those are more unclear. Hold on to the truth that comes to us from Christ in the church. God bless you. See you next time.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deep for truth or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? Meaningless thought, the shell appears strong. but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time.